Well, I'm glad to be back here in East Alton with you all. There's been a lot of changes since the last time I was here. Obviously, Forrest and his family wasn't here, and I'm very thankful to Forrest and particularly to Terry for opening up their home to me, particularly in light of the delicate condition that she is in. So it's very nice of them to be able to have me in their home. And I've noticed this technology has just boomed here. I've never worn one of these things in my life, so this is brand new to me, and it feels like I have somebody constantly tapping me on the back of my head. I was making the observation to Dave that if I had long hair, I could cover this thing up back here, but I don't have much hair at all, so consequently, that's going to be a part of the what you see. But the nice thing about it is it's tan, so it kind of blends in with my skin color. But it's good to be here. I'm very happy for the invitation to come and to be with you once again and to be able to renew acquaintances with those that I remember. And I don't remember all of you, but I do remember a good part of you, at least your faces, even though I may not remember your names. But it's very good to be here and to be with you. This week I want to talk to you about attributes of God. We're going to be talking about God being an awesome God. And there's a variety of things that we're going to pursue in the in our studies throughout this week that I hope will help us to come to a greater appreciation, not perhaps a better understanding, although I suspect that that would be the case, but a greater appreciation for the God that we serve, for who He is and what it is that He has done for us, especially through Jesus on the cross. And so we're going to be thinking about a number of these attributes of God, and I want to start this morning by talking to you about the concept of God's faithfulness. And the primary text that we're going to be using for this lesson in the this period of time is going to be a text found in Isaiah chapter 40. So if you want to be opening your Bibles there, I will join you in that particular text in just a few minutes. But the way I want to begin this lesson is by talking about the fact that one of the things that I think is clearly obvious in the world in which we live is that there's a lot of suffering in it. And there's all kinds of examples of that that we could use to illustrate that very point. Like, for instance, the horrific things that are happening over in Syria right now with a lot of people, particularly innocent people, who suffer. And generally, when you get involved in any kind of war, it is a fact that innocent people wind up suffering and suffering to a great degree. But that's the nature of war. And yet, be that as it may, we still find it to be something that is very troubling because these are innocent people who are going through some very difficult times as a result of the politicking that is done throughout the different countries in the world, which creates a lot of this tension. But then there are the kinds of sufferings that people experience, like, for instance, what is happening in Colorado right now. I was looking online this morning, and I found that there are 500 people that are still unaccounted for. They don't know where they are because of this massive flooding that is going on. And I suspect that once they begin the process of accounting those people, they will find that some of them are probably dead. Most of the people who are affected by it are affected in a way that, having lived through it, they are suffering as a result of the loss of their property, perhaps a loss of some things that are so precious to them that will never be able to be replaced. And so they wind up suffering through that. But I think when we deal with suffering, we don't have to go as far as Syria. We don't even have to go as far as Colorado. We can oftentimes look within our own lives. And what we oftentimes see and what we experience is the fact that there are those of us who are suffering physically. There are those of us who are suffering emotionally, things that we are going through, struggles that are happening in our lives that just make life somewhat difficult. And it is times like this when you find that what happens is that people begin the process of turning their attention to God because they're seeking some kind of relief, some kind of help through this process that can get them through it and to bring them out on the other side of it a better person. And I think that that's a good thing, that people will turn to God when they go through these kinds of difficulties and these kinds of challenges. But a lot of times what happens is that In people's lives, they have this tendency to treat God kind of like an ambulance. And what I mean by that is that when you're sick, and I mean you're really sick, you want an ambulance to be around, but that's the only time you want him to be around. Because the fact of the matter is you don't like ambulances. You don't like what they stand for because you know that that means that you're hurting, that you're suffering, or somebody else is hurting and suffering that is close to you. And so oftentimes we treat God like that. We want him around when we're hurting. We want him around when we're suffering, but that's about the only time that we want him around. And then when we oftentimes are done with the suffering or it is finished, then what happens is that sometimes we're finished with God as well. I think that for some people, and particularly what we're talking about now are people of faith, that there are those who have sought the relief and sought the kind of consolation that they believe that God can give to them, and yet their sufferings continue. And as a result of those sufferings and the continuation of those sufferings, what oftentimes happens then is that people come to some incorrect conclusions about God himself. Like, for instance, it may be a philosophical conclusion like, well, God doesn't exist. Or it might be the conclusion that some have come to that God isn't powerful after all. Or it could be more of an existential, more of a personal sort of conclusion that a person comes to when they think something like, well, God must not really care about me because I continue to go through these kinds of sufferings. Or it may be that someone concludes that God just isn't fair after all. Or it may be that they conclude that our sufferings are hidden from God, that he must not be able to see what is happening in my life, and that would be because either he can't see it or perhaps it is because he chooses not to see it. And so consequently, what winds up happening is that this will invariably lead people to doubting God, which often turns into one of two things as they continue to have their relationship with him. And that is that they'll never leave him, but it could be that they become very discouraged in their walk with God. Or it might be that they become angry with God. Why are you allowing these things to continue to happen to me? I've been faithful to you. I've been serving you. Why are these things happening to me? Well, there's good news along this line in the sense that this is not something that is particularly new. Many times throughout history, people who were in covenant relationship with God experienced sufferings that they had to endure, and they sought God's help to deal with it, and yet they continued to suffer. And the consequence of that was that they came to some very erroneous conclusions about the nature of God and about God's ability. Like, for instance, I think the best illustration would be Job. Job was a man who was faithful to the Lord. He served him. Even in the midst of the trials, when he lost his family, when he lost his property, and then when it began to inflict himself. Job said in the 13th chapter of the book of Job, in verse 24, he says to God, he says, "Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? Will you frighten a driven leaf and pursue dry chaff?" So you see, Job had this perception that God had hidden his face from him. He had this understanding that God was now treating Job like an enemy, even though that wasn't the case at all. The psalmist also pins some things about this. There's an example of this. In fact, there's many examples throughout the Psalms, but one I want to note with you is found over in the 44th chapter of the book of Psalms, where there in the 23rd verse, the psalmist writes, "Awake, why are you sleeping, O Lord? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and our oppression?" And now we come to the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah. And listen to what the children of Israel would be saying while they were in Babylonian captivity. As Isaiah writes in this 40th chapter, verse 27, he says, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God?" That was their understanding. God couldn't see what was happening to them, that God wasn't being just, that God wasn't being fair. Is it in fact true that God does see the trials and the difficulties that we go through in life? Is it true that God cares for us? Is it true that God is faithful to his people? Well, this morning, in this particular session, what I want us to understand is the fact that the Bible testifies to the fact that God does see our trials and our difficulties, that he does really care when we go through these things, and that it is in fact the case that God is faithful to his people. And the way I want to do this is by looking at this passage, this chapter 40, which I think more than anything impresses us with the faithfulness of God to His people. And it's my prayer that as we go through this study, that if you are discouraged in your relationship with God for whatever reason it may be, or perhaps if you happen to be angry with God, then I hope that this will be able to help you to understand and to see that God does care about you, and to help you to understand and to see that there is no reason to doubt Him, which then can give you comfort and it can give you strength in the midst of the trials that you have to endure. I want to begin then with basically an overview of this 40th chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah was an 8th century BC prophet. And what you will find in the book of Isaiah is, as you have studied this, I'm sure, that you will find that there are like these two sections that are just completely different from one another, in so much that there are a lot of scholars who have said that there is a second author of the last half of the book of Isaiah, what they call Deutero-Isaiah, that Isaiah wrote the first half of the book and then somebody else wrote the second half. Well, that's another lesson in and of itself, but I do believe that the internal evidence of the text indicates that it was the same author who wrote this. And not only that, but those who make the assumption that there are these two different authors do so because they do not believe in the concept of prophetic insight or of making predictions into the future, and particularly things that came true. They just discount that altogether. But the evidence would suggest that indeed it is Isaiah who wrote all of this. But being the case, what we see when we get into this 40th chapter is that he is writing about something that takes place 100 years after he was gone, after the particular historical context in which he himself lived. In other words, he's writing about the 6th century BC, and he is writing about the period of time in which Judah would be taken into Babylonian captivity. And in this text, he is speaking of what is going to take place, particularly with respect to the exile that they would experience and the sufferings that they would go through as a result of being captive to the Babylonian peoples. Chapter 39 of Isaiah actually ends the first part of Isaiah, and he is concluding this by telling King Hezekiah, one of the few good kings of the kingdom of Judah, that Judah is actually going to be taken into captivity. And you see that in verses 5 through 7 of this chapter when it says that Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And so he is telling Hezekiah, this is what is going to happen. And then when you get to the 40th chapter, he now is within the context of it actually happening. That is, he is predicting the things that would be taking place. And one of the things that he does is he points out that when Jerusalem would finally be destroyed by the Babylonian Empire, when their temple would finally be destroyed, that they would find themselves as a people who were who would be under the oppressive rule of this tyrant who would make their lives absolutely miserable. But just as in the first part of Isaiah, which ends with the message of doom, the second part of Isaiah actually begins with a message of comfort and a message of salvation. And in fact, that's how the 40th chapter begins. Comfort, oh comfort my people. The time that Isaiah has in view here is after a long period of captivity and misery that this kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom, would experience that would have been brought about because of their sin. Her long period of bondage and exile, he is predicting in this 40th chapter, is coming to a conclusion, that it would be over. She has been pardoned by the grace of God, and the scales have now been balanced. And there is a voice then that cries out, using a graphic figure of the kind of preparation that is done for a great king who is on a journey, indicating that the way for God's return to his people and their return back to the city of Jerusalem is just about to occur. And so he says in verse 3, a voice cries, "In the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill may be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. God's glory would be revealed, and they would be people who would marvel. And they would marvel when God would send their deliverer. And in this particular historical context, the deliverer, who he's going to speak about a little bit later, is actually King Cyrus, the Persian king who would come, who would defeat Babylon, and who would allow Israel to go back to their homeland and to once again rebuild their temple. And so he is talking about, in essence, this period of time in which Cyrus would be now the one who would be ruling, and he would permit them to go back. But there is also messianic implications in this. Because if, in fact, you are familiar with what was spoken about John the Baptist, the gospel writers, particularly the writers of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, indicate that John is fulfilling what was indeed prophesied by Isaiah over here in Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 3. And so what the synoptic writers do is they actually take the message of hope, this message of comfort, as one who would come delivering them, which Isaiah is applying to Cyrus, and they are taking it, and now they are applying it to Jesus, therefore giving it a much broader application, a much more significant application with respect to the coming of the Messiah himself. Now, the assurance that is given the people that this would occur was the fact that God had spoken it. As it says in verse 6, a voice cries, "Cry." And I said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is as grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely the people are like grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." And what he is pointing out here, it seems to me, is that he is saying that human strength was inadequate to prevent from happening what God said would happen. God's word, by the very nature of what it is, because of who it comes from, would endure forever. It would be accomplished. And there is no human being who could prevent it from happening. And in that time frame, Jerusalem then is told to tell the good news to all of the cities of Judah, to not be afraid, but to shout the good news of what God has done for them, as he goes on in verse 9 and says, "Go on up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up and fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young." When this prophecy is fulfilled, God would come as a conqueror, and he would come overthrowing his enemies, redeeming his people, and exercising his rule. And when this prophecy is fulfilled, he would also come in tender compassion towards his people. Come as a shepherd tending his sheep, gathering and protecting them, and being the one who provides for them. And what is the assurance of all of this? The assurance is that God said he will do what he said he will do. Having declared to Judah that the basis of their hope is God's enduring word, Isaiah then goes on to impress them with what would be, at that time, a people who would be faltering. That is, in the 6th century B.C., they would be faltering. They would be doubting God. They would be doubting his faithfulness. And you just think about that. Once these people saw their city and the temple destroyed by the Babylonians, and then once they continued to experience the terrible trials and the sufferings at the hands of this Babylonian tyrant, their faith in God would be stretched to the breaking point. They would need assurance, and they would need a renewing of their faith, which would be accomplished by being reminded of God's infinite greatness, plus his unfailing love and his care for them. Remember, Isaiah, in his period of time in the 8th century, has already witnessed the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel at the hands of the Assyrian Empire. And it is only because of King Hezekiah and his faithfulness particularly, which, by the way, was very shaky, that God spared Judah. Actually, he spared the city of Jerusalem. But it's going to be destroyed. And what Isaiah is telling the people is when this happens, then understand that it's only temporary, that it's not going to go on forever, and that God will send comfort. And so he reminds them of God's faithfulness, and he does so within this chapter by asking a rhetorical question that actually shows them his magnificent greatness. In verse 25 of this chapter, he says, "To whom then will you compare me, that I should be like him?" says the Holy One. And what Isaiah did in this chapter is he actually answers this question before he asks it. And what he does is he shows, first of all, God's greatness in his creation, as he points it out in verses 12 through 14 when it talks about who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and hills in the balance. He's talking about this awesome power of God. His greatness is shown in the insignificance and the powerlessness of the nations that are round about, as he goes on to explain that in verses 15 through 17. And then in verses 18 through 20, his greatness is shown in the vanity and the powerlessness of the idols that they had created to serve. His greatness is shown in the weakness and in the impotence of the world's greatest leaders and rulers. They could stand before God, they couldn't stand before God because God's power would not enable them to be able to do that. And so to answer this rhetorical question, to whom will you compare me? The resounding answer is nobody. There is nothing that we could compare God to. And because of this, assurance is then given by God that unlike human beings, God does not grow weary. God does not faint, but he will accomplish what he said he will accomplish, and the result will be he will provide the joy and the strength that they needed as they waited on God to accomplish what he said he is going to do. This then is this picture, this marvelous picture of the comfort and the strength of God that we need to look at. And it is something that we need to understand because it does help us to recognize what is a very fundamental, very basic biblical truth about God, and that is his faithfulness, that God can and does provide to those who will have faith in him. And even in the midst of their sufferings and trials that life throws at them, God continues to be faithful. Now that's kind of an overview of the text. What I want to do now for the remainder of the time is to make what I hope are some good applications to this. The first thing I want to talk to you about is the development of the attitude of doubt that oftentimes we experience in our walk with God. In verse 27, which we began this lesson with, Isaiah says to these people, he says, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God?" As these people would be in this captivity, having experienced the horrible suffering at the hand of what was a merciless tyrant, they would begin to think that God apparently didn't care about them anymore. And they would tend to attribute the weaknesses of weariness and fainting, they would attribute that to God, and therefore conclude that God didn't have the power to act on their behalf. This would do one of two things for them. It would either cause them to turn away from God altogether and begin the process of serving idols, or it would cause them to be discouraged with him developing these incorrect ideas about God and about his character, about his nature, and about the things that he was capable of doing. Well, I want to suggest to you that that is a problem that still resides in the hearts of people today, even believers. As many people go through the trials and the sufferings of life, and particularly is this true if they are extended, and what I mean by that is that they go on for a long period of time, they often begin to think that God just doesn't care about them. And like Judah, there is this tendency to attribute to God our weaknesses. We take our weaknesses and we project it onto the God whom we serve, and we conclude that he can't help us out of these things. He can't make us feel better while we're going through them. And like Judah, what this does is one of two things. It may cause us to turn to other sources thinking that this will solve our problems and solve our pain. So we begin the pursuit of material things. And we get lost in this pursuit because we're trying to drown out what is the pain and the suffering that we're actually experiencing. Or we may pay our allegiance to some man or some particular philosophical system or wisdom of men that we may consider to be wise and all-knowing, and thus we become people who succumb to that kind of approach to life. In other words, we develop an other worldview besides the one that is called Christian. Or it could be that we begin the use of something that's going to numb our suffering and our pain, like drugs. Did you know that, interestingly enough, that the number one abused drug, and I'm using that in a broad generic sense today, are prescription pain medications? People who can actually get this stuff from doctors, and I've known people who've become addicted to those things. And the reason is not because physically they're hurting necessarily, although in many cases that's true, but it's because emotionally they're hurting. And they're trying some way to kill that pain. And it could be that they are finding some other kind of an alternative source in order to provide the strength that they need, which, like all forms of idolatry, only winds up creating the situation, or perhaps I should say making the situation, even more hopeless. So that's one of the ways people turn to things other than God Himself. Or it may be that they get discouraged in their relationship with God. Not that they're ever going to leave Him, but that they develop all kinds of wrong ideas about Him. And now, probably the only reason why they're serving Him is that they're scared to death of Him, that they fear Him. They fear what He will do to them. But nonetheless, they're still very discouraged. How do we overcome that? How can we prevent this attitude from developing? Because I'll tell you, I don't know what your situation is in your life at this moment. There may be some of you who are suffering physically. There may be some of you who are suffering emotionally. How do you overcome and prevent the attitude that Isaiah said was going to happen to the people of Israel when they were in this Babylonian captivity? Well, he gives us some insight to that. And there are a series of these, and I'm not going to be able to spend a great deal of time. I'm not even sure how much time I have. How much time, when am I supposed to quit?
When you hear the buzzer, you'll have 5 minutes.
When I hear the buzzer, okay. Okay, so I got 15 minutes. Okay. What?
10 total minutes left.
I have 10 total minutes left. Whoa, I better get hustling here. Okay, how do we do this? How then can we overcome and prevent this attitude? I want to suggest to you some things here. The first one is this. We need to look beyond our own little world. Look at what he says here in verse 26 again of this chapter. When he says, lift up your eyes on high and see who created these, he who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power and not one is missing. And then in verse 28, in the first part of that verse, he says, have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Many times when we experience the problems and the trials of life, all we can think about is ourselves. We're thinking about our pain and how miserable we are. And what happens is that we get lost in our own little world, not really knowing what's going on. And the tendency then is to lose all objectivity, thinking that our own little world is the way that the universe is. In other words, it's the idea, I'm suffering, so the world must be suffering. And in essence, what happens is we lose touch with the reality that is there. It clouds our understanding of who God is and what is really happening. But in order to correct this, we have to look away from ourselves and the boundaries that we have set within our own present distress, because there is more to this world and there is more to God's ways than my own little world in which I live. One man put it this way. He said, divert your thoughts from this self-world to the immense universe. And when this feeling comes that God doesn't care, then I would submit to you that what we need to do is we need to be people who are looking beyond ourselves to the hosts of heaven and beyond to see the God of infinite power and infinite love who cares and who never forgets. The second thing we need to do is to understand the omnipotence and the omniscience of God. As he says in verses 12 through 14 of this chapter, Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man knows his counsel or shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? It is this that God called upon Job to do. You might remember when Job has said all these things about God that were wrong, and God finally calls Job to him and he says, okay, you're so smart, you know everything, you tell me. Were you there when I did this? Were you there when I did that? And what he began to realize, that is what Job began to realize, is that he didn't know what he was talking about. There are many things we don't understand. And perhaps there are things we will never understand about human suffering. But one thing is for certain, and that is that God does care. He is not frail like we are. He does not faint. He does not grow weary. He knows everything about us, and He knows what we need. A third thing is to realize that He has the power to strengthen you, and that's exactly what He wants to do. As he points out in verses 29 beginning, he gives power to the faint. To him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youth shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. We need to realize that God has the power to strengthen us, and that is exactly what he wants to do. And we need to accept that. And then we need to be people who wait on God. And basically, I think what that is just simply another way of saying have faith in Him. Trust Him. It's those who wait on God who receive this strength, this renewal of strength. And the expression here, wait on God, I would point out to you, it's used many times by Isaiah throughout the writings that he gave us here in this book, and it's synonymous with the idea of having this confident trust in God. But what we need to understand about this idea of waiting is that this does not mean become inactive. It doesn't mean that we don't do anything, that God does it all and we just wait for Him to do whatever it is He's going to do. And to try to get this understanding, or sometimes we develop an understanding that if I try to actively get involved in this, then we only get in the way of God and we frustrate ourselves as well as frustrating God's plan. So I'm just going to wait. And that's not what the idea is here. It's not inactivity, it's just exactly the opposite. The text shows that we're supposed to run, we're supposed to walk as we are waiting on the Lord. And the point is that we continue to actively serve God, patiently enduring whatever comes our way in life, earnestly hoping for and looking for and expecting God's salvation. And then with this attitude, we will be renewed in strength. And so basically what it boils down to is this, is if you're going through these difficult times, do not stop your faithfulness to the Lord. You might not understand what's going on. You may even become disappointed and angry, but don't ever stop serving Him. Wait on Him. Trust Him, because He knows what He's doing. And so the results of this are basically two things. Those who do this will mount up with wings like eagles. And the idea is like an eagle soaring to the heights that no other bird is able to soar to. And so will those who have waited on the Lord be able to soar to those kind of heights. And they will run and not be weary. The idea here is excitement. It's the eagerness for the journey and the rush to make preparation coupled with the continual progress made on this journey without getting weary. If you are a person of faith and you're anticipating something, and what you are anticipating is the consummation of everything, that Jesus is coming back again. He is the one who has already come into human history and the one who God used in order to be able to show what is going to be like on the other side. That is, when everything is consummated. The future has come into the present in Jesus Christ. And I don't know what we will be like, but we will be like Him when He comes again. And that's what we look forward to. That's what keeps us going, because we are anticipating something. And so we mount up with wings like eagles. We run without getting weary. We walk and do not faint. And the idea there is that there will be no problems whatsoever. that there will not be problems as we encounter this, but we will have the strength to be overcome them. You know what most of life consists of? The mundane things. Life is boring sometimes. It's just boring. I mean, after all, where I moved from Kansas City to Kingsport, Tennessee, beautiful country, but it's a little bitty town compared to Kansas City. My wife gets frustrated because she can't go to a grocery store and find the kind of groceries that she could in Kansas City. That's life. And that's boring. But that's what we all go through. And so we continue to walk, and we won't faint, even through the boredom of life. Life has a lot of suffering in it, and at times we have to experience it in our own lives. But we need to remember that God is with us and that He cares about us and that He is faithful. He is faithful to His covenant and to His promises. And He is going to do what He said He is going to do. Isaiah confirmed that with these people of Judah before they were even in Babylonian captivity. And what we need to understand is that we continue to walk through a broken world. We're all damaged people, and we're all looking for the final time in which Jesus comes again, and we anticipate that we will be taking our place in that new age. So let us soar with wings of eagles. Let us run and not grow weary. Let us walk and not faint. Let us look beyond our own little universe, our own little world, and look to the God above, the God who is faithful to His promises. I look forward to spending the rest of the week with you talking about these kinds of attributes of God, and I thank you so much for your attention this morning.